kind of moving on to how do we get into ketosis, and like practically what should we be eating and things like that. And what I'd like to start with is time of eating. One of the key ways that you would suggest getting into ketosis is time-restricted eating. So can you talk about what you think is kind of the best window for that?
Yeah. And believe it or not, it's not even now at a point of, you know, what I think is the best window. Mm-hmm. There's a number of very good studies, both in animals and in humans now, that probably a eating window of about 6 to 8 hours is probably the best window to work for. Now, what that means is if you're in a 6-hour eating window, that's a 18-hour fasting window. If you're in a 8-hour eating window, that's a 16-hour fasting window. What we do know is from Italian athlete studies that a 12-hour fasting window has no benefit. It's a good place to start, but there's no benefit in a 12-hour eating window, like 8 to 8 or 7 to 7. But for most people, it's very difficult to ask them if they eat breakfast at 7 o'clock in the morning, tomorrow, I want you to start eating breakfast at noon. And, you know, I want you to wait that long. And most people, because they don't have metabolic flexibility, you know, fall flat on their face. They get hungry, they get a headache, they get hangry, as the expression says. So what I try to do in the book is kind of hold the reader's hand and basically say, okay, I know you eat breakfast at 7. Next week, let's have breakfast at 8 o'clock. You can make it an hour. Come on. And we'll do that during the week. And then on the weekends, you can take time off and enjoy yourself. The next week, okay, you made it to 8 o'clock. This week, let's just move one more hour. Let's start at 9 o'clock. And you only have to do it for 5 days, and then we'll take the weekend off. And so on. So over 5 weeks, we just change an hour every time. And it's like any other training program. You have to train your cells to become more and more metabolically flexible and make the transition. And we, you know, we supplement with MCT oil, or there's other tricks in the book, like having a handful of nuts, which actually won't break ketosis during the morning, which is work from my friend Walter Longo from University of Southern California. So there's all these tricks to make us, you know, slowly transition into a shorter and shorter eating window.
Right. And you will begin to see ketosis after about 12 hours.
Yeah, you actually begin, most people who are metabolically flexible will begin to start making ketones about 8 hours after stopping eating. At 12 hours, it's just ramping up. Now, as I mentioned, there was a very good study done with Italian athletes looking at eating window and weight loss, and also a longevity marker called insulin-like growth factor 1, IGF-1. And these athletes all had to eat the exact same food for 3 months. But one group of athletes had a 12-hour eating window. The other group of athletes had a 7-hour eating window. And they were followed for 3 months. Same food, same amount of calories. The 7-hour eating window athletes lost weight. The 12-hour window didn't. The 7-hour window plummeted their insulin-like growth factors, and it's one of the best markers for longevity we have, whereas the 12-hour eating window, people didn't. So what happened? Well, when the 12-hour guys were just starting to ramp up their ketone production, boom, breakfast arrived, and they went out of ketosis. On the other hand, with ketone production ramping up at 12 hours, now you've added an additional 5 hours of being in ketosis. And you have an additional 5 hours of ketones being signaling molecules to tell mitochondria to uncouple and to make more of themselves. So that explains, you know, the difference on why this works and why it's so effective.
So one question, as you kind of shrink the window, right? And I believe that you go all the way down to like one meal a day, right?
Yeah,
like
one meal a day. Yeah.
Protein. So as we get older, right, absorbing protein actually becomes harder because, and then we get sarcopenia. And I also saw that you can only absorb like 20 to 25 grams of protein at a single sitting. So then if you only have one meal a day, how do you get enough protein? I mean, how does that get squared?
Oh, that's a great question. And this is something that Walter Longo and I disagree about, and we disagree in a friendly manner. It is true that adults seem to have a higher protein requirement in later life. And he argues that that's because we somehow magically need more protein. I argue that the reason adults need more protein is because we've consistently damaged the gut membrane, the wall surface area of the gut, and that we have a much smaller area to absorb protein. And I see this in my own practice. I see many people with leaky gut, with gut wall damage, who have low protein levels, who are older. But when we seal their leaky gut, their protein levels dramatically jump up. So a way of looking at it, normally the surface area of our gut to absorb food is the same surface area as a tennis court. Imagine that tennis court has shrunk to a ping pong table. Well, of course, you're going to have more protein trying to get, you know, absorbed through that smaller space. So my own personal practice follows this in human beings. And despite the fact that I limit their protein, once the wall of the gut is repaired, everything straightens out.
So a little diversion on that. So sealing the gut, could you talk very briefly about how you do that? Because that the leaky gut is an issue that a number of people have.
Well, quite frankly, Hippocrates 2,500 years ago said all disease begins in the gut. I've paraphrased him to say that all disease begins with a leaky gut. And I have not seen any disease process that can't be traced back to a leaky gut. It's not pseudoscience. Dr. Alessio Fasano, who's now at Harvard, proved that, for instance, gluten and other lectin-containing foods cause leaky gut and showed the mechanism on how that happens. So, most people, for instance, with an autoimmune disease have leaky gut. I'm becoming more and more convinced that most people with dementia, most people with heart disease have leaky gut. And so, yeah, I think it's a big deal. And one of the things that I talk about in the book, as in all my books, is it's not so much what I tell you to eat that's so important, it's what I tell you not to eat that's important. And getting gut disrupting foods out of our diet is, I think, a very important place to start.